Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two co-hosts. There is Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Yes, hello, I am here.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage. Okay, great. Off to a great start. Today we'll be talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Notable pause in my voice to keep myself from saying Rise. That's going to become a runner, so take a shot every time I mess up the title of this movie. You'll be blitzed about halfway through the show, I would wager. Before we get into that, no discussion today. You know, not really anything going on in the movie world that we felt was worth noting.
When's the last time we had a discussion?
Excellent question. It's been something previously, I'm sure. We've been doing some double reviews,
which I
like a little more than doing a discussion, especially when our goddamn movie is about a bunch of apes dawning.
Yeah, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, so like, you know, we could have done like favorite ape movie, favorite movie that incorporates Dawn in the title. Yeah, but why? Why would we do that? So we're just going to skip over that. We're going to do Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Before we get into that, I'd just like to remind everyone to give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. Make sure to follow us at Film Stage Show on Twitter. That'll help you keep on top of all the giveaways and stuff we do. Speaking of giveaways, we're going to tell you who the winner of the Enemy Blu-ray is, and we'll also be giving away a Blu-ray of Under the Skin, the newest film by Jonathan Glazer, starring Scarlett Johansson, that we talked about on this podcast a while back. We all quite enjoyed it. So look forward to being able to get one of those for free. Other than that, longer comments can go to podcast@thefilmstage.com. Before we get into Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I do want to say that last week I'd said that I would read the Snowpiercer comic, the graphic novel.
Oh, yeah.
And get back to y'all. So I read it, and I would say, like, there's a couple of similarities. Like, the world is frozen, and they're on a train, and nobody likes the tail section. And, you know, that's about it. Yeah, it's not an action comic. I don't even know that I would say that it's a good comic, in all honesty. I mean, it's interesting. The concept is interesting. But it's very thin. It's very, very thin. And it sets up a world that it then, you know, it races towards a conclusion. It's not a continuing tale. So, also the train is a lot more just like a normal train. Like, it's not a futuristic, awesome train. It does, of course, break through snow. But other than that, the illustrations pretty much show your average, like, sleeper cars and...
Is there the line about the kids?
No okay. Lines regarding children.
So that's all Bong and or Kelly Masterson.
Yeah, I was really able to let me see the way that I think a lot of adaptations should go, where you take, like, a cool idea and then give it your own little twist, which I think is something we talked about in Enemy as well. So... Yeah, just wanted to say that. Speaking of Snowpiercer, saw it again, and the second viewing actually made me like the film even more. I'm going to be writing a review for DearFilm.net about that, so if you want deeper thoughts on that, check that out there. Suffice to say that the second viewing has fundamentally altered the takeaway I got from the movie, and actually made it vaguely more optimistic, even though the new takeaway heavily centers on a massive flaw in what would be considered the psychological or biological programming of humanity. So, that's cryptic. Let's move on. Today, like I said, our primary review, our only review, will be Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the sequel to Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which starred James Franco and Andy Serkis under digital effects as Caesar. Andy is back. Franco is not. In his place, we find Jason Clarke, Gary Oldman, Kerry Russell, and Cody Smit-McPhee.
thing about them, they don't need power. Lights, heat, nothing. That's their advantage. That's what makes them stronger.
We both have families. You want to protect yours, I want to protect mine. It's our only chance for peace.
So Dawn of the Planet of the Apes takes up 10 years after Rise of the Planet of the Apes. The sickness that was briefly glimpsed in the last film has ravaged the Earth, codenamed the Simian Flu. And it left humanity in tatters, and humanity, as always happens in a movie like that, began fighting itself. Things have kind of settled down. Humankind is in remnants. Into this world, we are introduced through a band of apes, still led by Caesar, in the forests outside of San Francisco. And they've set up a life. They've set up a colony. They have a moral code, a kind of three commandments, it seems. They've set up a functioning society, a society that is thrown into chaos when man, for the first time in 2 years, re-enters the picture in the form of a group of explorers from a nearby colony of humans who are hoping to use a hydroelectric dam as a means of restoring power to their flagging civilization. So we'll start off the review going over our feelings of the previous film in brief, and then talk about how we felt about the new film, and then we'll move into a spoiler section to talk about plot if it becomes necessary. So Nick Newman, your thoughts, I know we went over this briefly last week, but give us your thoughts on Rise, what it did well, what it didn't do well, and then how this movie either improves or fails to live up to that film.
Okay, well, it's been about 3 years since I saw Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I've seen sections of it since on HBO and the like, getting a feel for it again and trying to figure out if my positive reaction was not very much buoyed by sort of the surprise of it not being terrible. Because the idea of restarting a franchise like Planet of the Apes with sort of an origin story, prequel, reboot starring James Franco, oh, that sounds problematic. And then it actually did a lot of things pretty well, but a lot of that goodwill also comes from a second half which improves upon the first. I think that what the film did well, at least what I think has been maintained in the rewatches that have occurred since its release, or at least rewatches of sections, is that above all, the movie has just sort of a seriousness to it that's not gritty. It's not one of those dark and gritty reboots that have become so popular. It just looks at things with a surprisingly sober eye, and it treats this business seriously. The idea Planet of the Apes, I mean, it sounds silly, and even the original Planet of the Apes actually does at times play the whole thing for laughs. The idea of how, you know, the idea of how absurd this is. And I think that the movie Rise of the Planet of the Apes has a good sense of humor about it. The idea of monkeys getting loose and basically taking over a city and then running into a forest. Apes. My apologies.
My God.
My apologies. So Dawn of the Planet of the Apes has an interesting responsibility on its hands because it has to follow that up and progressively phase out humans and make it so that apes can carry a film and that you can convincingly render the end of humanity and also do so in an entertaining way. And it pretty much has to be entertaining because this is a summer blockbuster we're talking about.
Right.
But what I've always liked about the Apes series, there are only two Apes films that I think are bad, which is the fifth in the original series, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and the Tim Burton remake.
Oh, man, I forget about that, and then people mention it, and I'm just like, oh, God, that wasn't a nightmare.
Yeah, although I will say that the makeup work in that film by Rick Baker is really incredible.
It's amazing. It's fantastic.
Yeah. It's actually the best ape work in any of the films. I think that's pretty tragic. But
including
the best ape
this
work,
one.
Including this one, because it's just this very detailed effect work that really feels like it's grafted right onto an actor's face. So there's a lot of expressiveness. It really looks like a walking, talking ape.
Yeah. I mean, that movie, like, they're... From what you're saying about that movie, I'll put it out there. Like, it's incredible the amount of expression that they were able to get out of those people. And some of those performances under that makeup were weirdly affecting.
Right. I mean, look at Tim Roth in that movie.
Yeah.
And it looks really impressive. But anyway, we're here to talk about Dawn. It is 2014, not 2001. So I will say that what I've always liked about the Ape series is that it is, I think, true sci-fi. I think it really treats, again, it treats this material with seriousness, and it uses the material to look at issues of the day. I think that the first one's connection to that is a little more tenuous. There is sort of the idea of the perils of space travel, which the United States government was getting more and more into at the time. The film was only 1 year out from the moon landing, for instance. The second movie concerned nuclear power, it concerned nuclear war. The third movie concerned immigration and overpopulation. The fourth had to do with segregation and gentrification and the problems of inner cities. The fifth, I don't know what was going on there, really. That's a terrible film. and where Rise dealt with genetics, I think that Dawn takes a very serious eye at the issues of gun control. I think it takes a very serious eye at the issues of the Second Amendment. Because what's funny about this movie is that you could almost argue that really nothing would have happened if people just kept their guns in their holsters, if people weren't so reactionary and didn't think to shoot first.
Not even... Okay, so this is going to tip my hand as to how I feel about this film. Not people. One fucking guy.
Yeah.
One asshole who's never given a reason outside of the fact... It's like if I had an abject hatred of pigs.
Well, he has given
because
some
of the
reason.
Swine flu.
Well, that's not a fair equivalent, because this is swine flu, you know, killed a few people and gave some other people the flu for 2 weeks. This is, to his eye, wiped out all of humanity. And it is sort of this threat, you know, in the forest.
Okay.
I
get it, but I really think that they hired an actor who they're like, this guy can convincingly play a real jerk from the word go, and we don't have to really flesh out why.
You need a villain.
Yeah, but I understand what you're saying.
So anyway...
There's a lot of villains in this movie.
Yes, there are. I think this movie does a very good job of handling it. I think there is... I do think it is serious-minded. And I think that it has a very sobering view of these issues. And it's not reactionary. It is saying that, you know, our attachment to guns is going to kill us. But it is also not acting as if this is all the effect... of it's not saying that the world is in tatters because of this, but it's sort of these issues that become highlighted and exacerbated by the situations they're in, which is a common trait of the Ape series. On top of that, though, I mean, if you just think about other components of it, I like this movie a lot because I think that Matt Reeves is a very good director. I think he's very good at composing space. I think he's very good at putting characters in spaces and creating a cohesive relationship between them. Where the action scenes have a real sense of scale, and there's something very clean about the relationship between two shots of one character firing one, another character firing back. There's a tension there. You know, we should mention that Matt Reeves, directed Cloverfield, and you can actually see in the movie there is actually a shot that I think recalls Cloverfield directly, which is the beginning of the third act. It takes place at night. It involves horses. Horses and fire.
Are there horses in Cloverfield?
No. Well, there is a shot of a horse in Cloverfield, but, it's the shot of, you're seeing from behind a parked car and there's this chaos going on. And, there's a real fluidity to it. It actually kind of reminds me of Alfonso Cuarón's work in Children of Men. In certain ways.
Okay.
It's not quite as good, but
this is some high praise you're leaping onto this thing.
but I think it kind of has the same character to it. The movie, I think, is a very good action film. I think it has a real momentum to it. I think that it's very well balanced tonally and structurally. I do have some issues with the structure, which we'll get into later, but I think that it balances the ape and human side very well. I was invested in both, and I really didn't want to see either. I didn't want to see the two factions go head-to-head. I didn't want to see people get hurt, which is rare for a movie like this. I actually cared about what was going to happen. And that also comes down to the cast that you have. Andy Serkis' performance as Caesar, I think, is one of the great motion capture performances we've ever had between these two films. And the other ape work is very impressive. I know Toby Kebbell is here somewhere, and so is Judy Greer.
Yeah, Toby Kebbell plays Koba.
Koba, right, the ape... The bad
crucial
ape.
Crucial character.
Crucial
you
character.
Can tell he's the bad ape because he's the one with the scar on his eye. He's the human hating aspect of the apes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got his reasons, but you know, he's kind of a jerk about it. Judy Greer, there must be a director's cut of this film where she had more to do.
Yeah.
As Cornelia. I mean, the fact that her IMDb has a name for her character is shocking to me, because I don't think they ever said it in the movie.
She the wife or the mom?
She's the wife.
The mother. Okay.
Oh, yeah, the wife, mother, the Caesar's wife.
Yeah.
Which, I want to see that story.
Yeah. So, and then you also have the likes of Jason Clarke. On the human side, you have Jason Clarke. You have, her name is escaping me.
Carrie Russell.
From The Americans and Felicity.
Yes. You also have J.J. I almost said J.J. Abrams because you said
yeah.
J.J. Abrams is this film. And Gary Oldman basically playing a more reactionary Commissioner Gordon. You know, I don't know. It's just, it's a really well-rounded piece of entertainment that I think has a head on its shoulders and does a good job of playing serious and speaking to serious issues while also featuring a shot of an ape riding a horse, screaming, and firing a machine gun in either hand.
I was about to say, dual wielding, fire jumping, horse riding.
Yes.
Ape.
I saw that shot and I thought to myself in that moment, the medium, the arts, has attained its full purpose.
Yeah, just shut it down.
let's burn everything
that came before it. This is our new starting point.
I was going to say, let's end now. Let's end with the film that contains this image. And better yet, that I think it can actually pull it off, because it is one of those things that's so crazy.
Did you laugh when that happened?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, it's funny because it's in the middle. It's in the middle of a serious scene where people are being killed, and yet I thought it was fun. So that to me, like that moment, kind of encapsulates my feelings for the eighth series.
Do you think it was striving for that?
I think that's in there. I don't think you take the time to conceive, shoot, and then motion capture that kind of image and not have some humorous element to it.
I mean, it must have been meant to be humorous, but as such, its place in that scene astounds me. This is something we can get into more in spoilers, I guess, but like, there's a tonal disharmony in this film, and I don't know if it's because of the inherent... I don't want to say stupidity, because that sounds very reductive, and I'm going to really try not to be reductive. But there is a campiness to what is happening in this film that I think robs it of a lot of whatever impact it could have.
Hmm.
But Nick, please, finish up your thoughts, and then we can get to Danny.
Yeah, so... I think that there are actually moments where this really does approach being a great film. Again, I have structural issues with it that kind of become a bit more prominent later on when certain things don't click as well as I think they were intended to.
Right.
There are certain issues that, speaking emotionally, really, there's an emotional gravity that I think isn't completely held because of how the focus was delineated. But... I found a lot to admire, and as someone who's been an apes fan most of their life, I came away from it very happy.
Okay, Danny King, what about yourself? What were your thoughts on Rise first? Let's not forget about that through line.
Yeah, I don't have much of a recollection, but I recall feeling positively about it, and I think as Nick mentioned, I can't remember how much of that was due to low expectations. Probably a lot of it. I'm not sure how well it would hold up. Because most of the things I do remember about it were the stuff I didn't like. For instance, the guy that ran, like, the prison.
God, that whole...
Yeah, like it kind of...
That whole plot was just aggravating to
me. It seems like...
Although one of them is Brian Cox, which you have to give credit for.
Well, Brian Cox
is a master. One of them's Brian Cox, who can play a bad guy. The other is Draco Malfoy. And when you cast Draco goddamn Malfoy as a warden at an ape prison in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, you, like, lose me immediately.
Yeah.
Because it's... Danny, it's your turn.
That stuff was really bad.
It was fucking terrible.
And, you know, you mentioned, like, the little role Judy Greer has in the new film. I don't even remember, like, a single scene that Frida Pinto was in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh my God, I forgot she was in that movie.
I think I just realized that like a couple days ago, like remembering. But I don't remember much that she had going on.
They fell in love. And
they did.
She remained in love with him.
Did she die?
Maybe. I don't think she did.
Not in the movie.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of people died between movies, so it's a possibility.
And then, yeah, in terms of going into Dawn, I remember, I wasn't looking too much forward to it or anything, but I remember seeing the teaser trailer for the first time, and it just starts with that close-up on Caesar and then pulls back. And I remember thinking, like, okay, this looks way too serious. Like Nick said, Rise had a bit of, like, a levity to it that was appealing. And that teaser trailer just gave me a lot of wrong kind of expectations for the movie. Like, it just looked to be taking itself way too seriously. And then the beginning of the movie starts with one of those terrible fake news montages that tries
all
to...
All the goddamn rage.
Yeah.
I mean, it was in Snowpiercer.
Yeah, Snowpiercer, I mean, it's not really good in any movie. It's not even... At least Snowpiercer isn't, like... Doesn't have an animated map with, like, red lines across it. I don't know.
Yeah, there was... Well, the opening map I kind of was okay with because it showed the spread of the virus, which was, like, eh. But then you started to realize that, like, the lights were starting to go out.
Mm. Oh,
so
yeah,
that tied in later on to the concept of, like, power.
Yeah.
You know, the need for it. Which is, like, you know, that's one of the more positive things I'll say about this film is that the opening montage that all the news clips were over really tied into the rest of the movie.
Very coherent.
Yeah. They did do that thing I love where, like, they have a clip of an actual world leader saying something.
Yeah.
And it was, like Barack Obama. And he was like, you know, gather up your family and get to a safe place.
Yeah, it's like, who do they think they're convincing? Yeah. Like,
I was like, who? Well, my initial thought was, what was that from? Like, what did I miss that Barack Obama had to say that? Mm-hmm. Unless it was, you know, digital trickery, like making JFK say that a guy has to pee.
No, they worked through hours and hours.
It was like a supercut?
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, it didn't start well, but. I have to say that I ended up liking the movie more than I thought I would, and a lot of it was just because of how much I liked the material with the apes. And I'm starting to realize that talking about this movie is just going to sound weird to say, like, the ape stuff was really good. but, I mean, like, the first conversation that the two apes have, it's, like, Caesar and then, like, a nice ape, or is it Koba?
It's Koba.
So he's still kind of nice at that point.
Koba he is the, like, wild card best friend.
Yeah.
You know, like in a heist movie or something. It's like, you know, what's wrong with Joey, man? He just shot that cop in the face. And it's just like, man, Joey's seen some shit, but he's good. He's on our side.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone knows in that movie that Joey's gonna go fucking crazy at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
But yeah, like, they have a conversation, and told through sign language. And I was amazed by how affectless it was. Like, it was just a normal dialogue scene and nothing about it felt show-offy or, like, you know, look how convincing these motion capture performances are. It just felt like a normal dialogue scene. I was just watching it without any kind of a filter or, like, inherent amazement. And I was really impressed by that. There's some stuff, like, probably the birth of the child that feels a little bit like that show-offy stuff. Like, oh my God, look how cute this is. It's like a baby ape. But overall, I thought all that stuff was really convincing. And even like the production design of their community, I thought was really impressive.
It was familiar. Did anyone else feel it was familiar from something? The way that like the spikes were coming out of the tree?
Yeah.
Was it like Swiss Family Robinson?
I don't know.
I just felt like I'd seen it somewhere, and I couldn't. Part of me was like, maybe I just saw it in a trailer. I don't know.
Maybe in the Dawn of the Apes trailer.
Possible.
It is quite familiar from the trailer. A lot of
was
this
it
movie.
In the trailer?
No, I'm kidding. But yeah, I also think that this movie, in terms of the craft, is a cut above a lot of blockbuster fare. I don't really know. I don't really have a handle on Matt Reeves as a director. It seems like he's jumped from like project to project. And I don't really remember his other films that well. But this film, it really doesn't kind of indulge in any of the kinetic style of, you know, standard blockbuster fare. There's one shot where, like, it's right after Gary Oldman gives his speech kind of early in the film, and it's like, I think the camera's placed in a hallway, and it's like he's coming up some stairs and Jason Clarke's waiting for him, and they have this conversation, and a lot of the scene is just in like one take, and it's just a long shot that has both of them in the frame. There's another one where like Jason Clarke is packing and him and Kerry Russell have a pretty extended conversation that's in one take. So there just seemed to be an overall patience to the style that I liked. That probably goes out the window a little bit when the apes are riding on horses and firing machine guns. But I mean, I wouldn't really overpraise the movie or anything, probably because a lot of the human characters seem kind of standard. Oldman's especially, just kind of his character seemed to get out of whack the more the movie went along. Like when we first see him, he did sort of seem like a Commissioner Gordon type, but by the end of the movie, he's just a kind of a crazy guy, and I don't think that transition was handled too well. But I would echo Nick's point about the treatment of gun violence, because every bullet, especially in the first 90 minutes, every bullet does have this huge impact. And that first time that ape shot at the beginning of the film, like you really feel like it's a significant event, even though the ape, you know, you almost assume the ape dies, but he doesn't.
Yeah, it was like grazing. Because in addition to being a shitty human being, that guy's a shitty shot.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's not a great character.
How do you miss something that's 5 feet away from you? anyway.
He was shaken, man. He was scared.
That's true. He was quite scared.
And there's even one scene later on. I mean, the movie's not subtle at all, but there's like one... There's just like a smash cut to a guy with a machine gun firing it into the frame.
Yeah.
It's just like, holy shit, like guns are really bad. But I did appreciate how seriously it handled that theme. So overall, you know, it bettered my moderate expectations. It's a decent film.
Okay. I hated Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh God, how do I even begin? Okay, so Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the movie that I'll forever remember as James Franco deep blue seeing humanity to the brink of extinction. Nick, you can tell me if I'm wrong, and maybe I am. I only ever saw the first Planet of the Apes, and even that as a young child, so I don't remember. Do they make it explicit how the apes became intelligent? Was it just evolution?
Yeah. No. I'll explain how this works.
As briefly as possible, and only sticking to the first film.
Okay, so, no, I can't.
No, you have to, for me. In the first film, it's the only one I've seen, so it's the only one that, this is how it frames my understanding. In the first film, the feeling that I got at the end of it was, humans had their shot, Cold War tensions rose, we destroyed ourselves, and then, nature abhors a vacuum, that the apes then just evolved into us, basically. Like, they evolved the speech and society that they learned, that they had then. And that the remains of humanity devolved because of their violent tendencies and nuclear winter and stuff.
See, sort of, but it's actually explained in the sequels. It's something much more complex and something much stranger than that.
Okay, but see, what I found
the first
harrowing,
movie just doesn't really concern itself with that.
Right,
is the thing,
and that's kind of what I liked. Like, what I found harrowing was the idea that this guy comes to a world that he thinks has gone wrong, and you know, humans are subjugated by apes. But what struck me in the thinking about it was, you know, when he's like, you maniacs, you blew it up, what he's saying is like, you blew up society, you blew up the planet, and the apes took over and became better stewards of this world than we were. And I liked that idea. And so to have that be replaced with the plot of Deep Blue Sea with monkeys instead of sharks it kind of drove me nuts because I hated it. Because it's like, how do we, you know, like you're on the 12th day.
And yet it's true to the larger series is the thing.
Which is crazy to me. Which is fine, I guess, because it fits in the larger series. But then I just have a problem with the whole series. And this is like, it's something I'll never be able to get away from. I apparently would have hated every other film in the series. And I didn't like Rise of the Planet of the Apes because I don't like the idea of the scientific hubris bringing us down. I like the idea of human nature bringing us down and, you know, another species looking around and saying we could do better and doing it.
But see, it's not really scientific hubris because if you recall,
okay,
at the end of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, it's actually sort of a contagion-esque virus spreading.
Spread because this guy was doing tests on this thing. And
no, but he wasn't. He was just a guy who got like sneezed on.
No. He's the guy who was in the room. He was one of the lab techs who was administering this vaporized...
No, it was the neighbor who's a pilot. Remember, he goes to the airport.
Right, but the guy who sneezed on him was already sick with the simian flu.
Right.
So patient zero is dude in lab. You know, Typhoid Mary is guy on airplane. To put it in weird terms that have nothing to do with each other. But so I had a problem with that. But I was willing to overlook that because, you know, I don't want to go to a movie and dislike it. And so I came into this film, and for the first 45 minutes, I was on board. I thought that the animation was beautiful, this nearly silent opening where the apes are hunting elk, I think. I would say caribou, but that doesn't seem like something that they have in California. Whatever they're hunting, it's a beautiful sequence, and it firmly establishes like the kind of prominence that apes have taken. And their nascent, you know, post-human society. And it was good. I liked it. I liked the way that they were setting up the relationships. And then I like the fact that the introduction of humans was done from the apes' point of view. Mm-hmm. And like you said, that first gunshot rattled me. Because even in that hunting scene, it was as silent as a hunting scene can be. Because they're using spears and bolos and rocks. And so I was okay with it. But then the movie falls into this almost romantic comedy-esque patter where the people, obviously the apes are like, we don't want none of you people in our world. Like, you got to stay out. And the people are like, well, we need that dam. And so it's like, okay, I'll give you like an inch. And then they take their inch and everything's like great. And you're like, you have the scene where everything is going perfect. And then bad things happen, and they're back to zero. But then, you know, oh, we figured out a way we can help you, and then everything's going perfect, and then a bad thing happens, and then back to zero. Like, I was fed up and exhausted by that by the time we finally get to the apes riding on horsebacks with guns. And then the movie, in my mind, should have ended, like, probably a half an hour before it did. The movie finds a perfect, haunting, insane place to end, and then pulls back as hard as it can.
Well, you'll have to tell us what it is.
Yeah,
and spoilers.
We'll get into it in spoilers. But needless to say, I was on the movie side. I was off of it, and then I said, "Holy shit! If this is how they're ending, I'm on board, and I'll be first in line to buy a ticket for the next one." They didn't do that, which is a huge missed opportunity. And they have a parallel that's a parallel only in so much as there are two characters under similar circumstances. There's Jason Clarke's character of Malcolm, who is the father of Cody Smith McPhee, who is now going to be typecast as, like, overprotected son in the post-apocalypse. Because this is the exact same character he was in The Road, except he says Papa less.
That'd be weird if he kept saying...
If he did, that would be incredible. But yeah, I mean, and like Caesar has his son, and then he has another son, you know, in the movie. And like, you could tell that there was supposed to be some kind of parallelism drawn there, but their stories don't parallel, it's just their circumstances. And, you know, Caesar seems to be working for ape kind, whereas Malcolm is working just for his son, So even there, the parallel falls down. Like, Malcolm has a point where he literally says, I don't give a shit about anyone else. I just want to protect my son from the things he's already had to see. It's just... there's an inherent flaw in the center of this movie. And what I think it is that, again, in the original Planet of the Apes, before the extended universe started happening, humanity is already gone. And humanity is felled by humanity as a whole. And in each of these films, you've had to find a villain on a human level, like on a personal level. And you can't keep giving me heroes and villains on a human level, because I will never be okay. I will never side with the apes. I just won't. They're not doing... They're just like this pacifist collective out in the forest. It's like, I don't care. You're not striving towards anything. You're striving towards a community and a home. You've already gotten it. It's as a person well-versed in Western storytelling, I root for the underdog. I root for the person who's scrabbling to survive. I root for the weakling because... It was in humanity's interest for weaklings to win, because we were the weaklings. When you put us back at that level, I'm gonna want us to win. I don't care if you have Caesar as this Christ-like figure, you know, leading his people to freedom. It doesn't matter to me. And the only way to make these apes seem so intelligent, like the problem I had with the last movie, was to make everyone around them incredibly stupid and cartoonishly evil. And in this movie, when they have one cartoonishly evil guy who has no power, so then they have to take someone who does have power and make him cartoonishly evil. And it blew me away. I will, however, say, I won't say in a million years. If you had locked me in a room over the weekend and say, come up with some social issues that this movie was tackling, I maybe would have gotten to gun control at some point. I think the problem there is that guns in this movie are more closely tied, in my mind, to the concept of power and technology than they are to just gun violence. It's just the way it is. Like, every time that people are talking, like, the apes are like, we can't let them do the power plant. Power is what gives them strength. And the people are like, you know, there may have more people than us, but we've got a shit ton of guns. And so it's all about what's going to tip the balance, which is something that kind of gets thrown out the window at some point. But I mean... When both of you brought up the gun violence thing, it made me think of The Onion. Maybe you all saw this going around. The Onion had... Oh, what's it
oh,
called?
Oh, the video.
The film... Yeah, like, yeah. It's called, like, their film signature film series or something like that.
And it's the first one I'd seen. I didn't... Is it a series?
It's a okay. series. Like, one of them was, like, The Hunger Games, and it's this guy. I'll say he's, like, 50 to 60 years old. And his name is, like, you know, Philip Rosenthal or something like that. And he's, like, Onion film critic. And, like, he's the stereotypical, like, you know, white male liberal artist, like, very much an intellectual. And he begins all of his reviews completely normal and then dips into, like, a character. So for the Hunger Games review, he just spent the entire time talking about how much hotter Gale is than PETA. Like, he's running down the plot and he's like, you know, will Katniss end up with PETA instead of Gale, even though Gale's like so much more hot than PETA is, like really, really hot. And so for this week's, it was Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and he's like, this is the sequel to the reboot of the, you know, following the remake of the blah blah blah, and then he just deadpans in the camera, and I'm fine with that. And it becomes like this de facto angry, like, throwing down the gauntlet to Hollywood. He's like, you know, do three 3D sequels of Citizen Kane and release them on the same weekend. I'll grind them up and I'll, like, swallow them whole. You know, you can't defeat me. He's like, you think I won't look at this piece of trash summer action film and be able to find some way to tie it into our socio-political, like... You know, you think I won't find a metaphor in there somewhere? Because I'll do it. And the second that Nick said that, I was like, wow.
I love how he brings up his education. He's like, I got 4 film studies degrees. Like, yeah. I'll churn this out all day.
It's pretty incredible. I'll see if we can post it along with this review. Because it's funny, and it's what we're doing right now. And I feel like the movie might maybe want to say something like that, but in the end, it is a movie that has an ape dual-wielding machine guns as it jumps through fire on horseback. A moment that I don't feel worked it well at all. I left at the sheer ridiculousness of that moment, divorced from any sense of like weight or necessity or urgency. Like, the second that happened, I was just like, I don't have to pay attention to anything this movie's saying anymore. I don't. Because it can't be trying to say something. Because if it was, it wouldn't give my eyes that shit to have to take in. Like, it could be a thrilling, rollicking action film, but I felt nothing during the action scenes.
Don't you love The Dark Knight Rises?
Yeah.
So, how is the absurd shit in that movie different? How is the mix of absurd shit and
I will once again say
sociopolitical material? How is Bane as a villain so different from the ape riding the horse shooting guns? Like, honestly, what? How is that?
The because fact Bane that you can ask that is incredible to me.
Because Bane is a stupid character. That's the thing. Because
Bane is not a stupid character.
Okay.
No. I want to keep going on this because I love the fact that this is happening right now. This is going to be our most accessible episode ever because we're talking about The Dark Knight Rises versus Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Bane is... Oh, fuck. Damn it. Drink. Here's the thing about Bane. He is an over-the-top character. He is. It's just the way that, you know, comic book movies do it. It's just how it is. But... At his center, there is something chillingly compelling about him because he is offering people something that a lot of people claim to want. There is a girl in my office who literally said, I wish the world would descend into anarchy. I think we would all be able to self-regulate better than these systems we put in place have. 100% serious. This is a woman with a corporate job, two children, and a husband. I don't know. I wanted to keep pressing on this, but I had a deadline and I couldn't, so I had to keep working. But Bane, he offers that up. And yeah, he's got the mask on, you know, but it's not above the realm of possibility that a guy wearing a CPAP machine could become a charismatic leader, especially when he lets people's intellectual egotism feed on the power that he is giving to them, even if the power is false. This is an ape riding a horse, leaping through fire, dual wielding machine guns.
No, but this is also an ape. This is also an ape that has those scars because it was, as he says, he was experimented on, he was tortured.
Right, and I was 100% with that. That's what, like, when they were bringing that up, I was like, they're making it seem like we don't deserve our place of prominence.
Right. And
which
I think
is a harrowing idea.
And I think there is a through line there. Yes, it is a villain, but I do think that the villain shows a reason for being the way. I don't want to say he or she, because it's an ape, but I think a villain shows how it is. It is, but okay. It feels kind of weird. I think that there is a coherent, believable, justifiable, et cetera, direction which it takes. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't on its side because it's a villain, but I did see where it was coming from. I can understand the frustration with the political machinations of Caesar, why that feels regressive and why he says, you know, Caesar love humans more than own son, et cetera, et cetera.
I appreciate the fact that you tried to put that into ape syntax for us.
Yes.
I see what you're saying, and this is my problem with this movie more than Rise. I disliked Rise more than I disliked Dawn, but Dawn made me more frustrated than Rise did because it came so close. If I know it's a cool image, if it hadn't done that, I think it would be easier to take. This is an animal that suffered under us and has reason to distrust us. And there are ways to show his rage. Like, if they had had him going primal, like straight primal, like a chimp is strong enough that it could dismember someone if it really wanted to. So if he had been, like, knocked off of that horse on a group of people and just started, to coin a phrase, or to borrow a phrase, going apeshit on them, it would have been so much more resonant. It would have been more powerful. It would have been an incredible moment in this film. But there's something so dissociative about the way that they frame this moment. They're like, they're playing it for the absurdity, but it's not working. It's just not for me anyway. I mean, obviously it worked for you, and I understand what you're saying, but it didn't land for me that way.
Well, I think there's glee for Koba at this moment. I think the movie is not necessarily relishing in that, but I think it's showing it very effectively. And I think that it is...
I didn't see glee. I saw rage. Maybe I...
No, I think there's happiness on its face as it's shooting up.
You are really...
Wow.
Just, like, not a fan of giving the apes any kind of personhood.
Yeah, sorry.
You are the problem.
Granted, I did feel a connection to them still, but...
I won't deny this movie what it does well. That, like I said, the first 45 minutes, perfect.
The great use of the weight.
The what?
Great use of the weight by the band.
Oh, yeah.
That was nice.
That was. There are moments in this movie that are really good and that really make you feel a certain way, but there are moments when plot just takes over and it really kind of hurts what's been built up. And again, I'll say this need to not even like give balance to humans and apes in equal measure, but to have to push them to like their most cartoonish sides. Like, I don't want to say that we should have like a Winds to War style, you know, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes film, but it would be good if we did. We can get into this more in spoilers though, because it's the ending of the movie that really, I think, hamstrings this film the most for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to say, you know, you mentioned the Onion video, which is funny, but it's also an Onion video. And I think that, pointing out that there is sort of a connection there is one thing, but there's also the fact that the socio-political content of the film is very much a part of the Ape series as a whole.
Right.
So it was something that I was kind of...
This is a film that does... you're primed for it walking into it.
It was something that I was kind of expecting going in, and I had heard rumbles about this, and I was kind of curious to see how it played out, and I thought it played out well. I don't think it really concerns itself as much with post-apocalyptic human relationships, which is sort of a problem because you have the... Did anyone else think of The Matrix Reloaded when we have the shot of the surviving humans partying in like the warehouse?
Yeah, a little bit.
that absurd dance sequence in The Matrix Reloaded, that came to mind. When that came back, I went, oh, right, there are other people here.
Right, yeah.
I kind of forgot it.
Yeah.
And that stood out to me as a problem.
That is a problem.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Danny, any final thoughts before we go into spoilers?
No, I think most of my other thoughts are spoilery, so.
Okay. Well, that's Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It's in theaters now. I say, I don't even know. I just don't even fucking know. I didn't like it. I won't deny that other people might be able to find something fun about it, but I wouldn't say to go see it. but everyone else seems to like it, so, you know, make your choices. But now we're going to get into spoilers, so we're going to talk about some heavy plot stuff. So if you haven't seen Rise of the... Damn it, drink. If you haven't seen Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, skip ahead unless you have no intention to see it and you just want to keep listening to us talk. So spoilers. Spoilers for Dawn. That's a half drink. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes starting now. So there's an escalating tension in this entire film, because Koba really, really does not trust people. And Gary Oldman really, really doesn't trust apes. Neither does this guy who was played by the guy who played Joe Torre in Band of Brothers. I don't know the actor's name.
Kirk Acevedo.
Yeah, Kirk Acevedo. He's the guy who's just a real piece of work. he thinks that, you know, constantly threatening the overwhelming force of apes is a good idea. He thinks he'll endear himself to people by bringing up their dead relatives. you know, not a great guy. Not the kind of guy you invite to parties. Anyway, he's the guy who fucks shit up each time. He shoots an ape. The ape is just winged, but, you know, that makes the apes come over to us on horseback.
Not a good start.
Yeah, just be like, apes don't want war, but we'll fight you. Good scene, actually. I really liked that scene. But anyway, so then later he smuggles a shotgun into the camp. And this, of course, happens right as, like, an adorable baby ape is crawling on everyone.
Yeah.
And it really seems like, oh, we're finally making a connection. And then it's just obvious that something bad is going to happen, because that's the rhythm that this movie has done. And then, surprise of all surprises, once everything's back to normal, it's actually Koba who causes the problem. And this is where the movie really started to get my attention in a good way. Koba shoots Caesar. Because here's one of the problems that I've had with this series. It's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Caesar is the leader. Caesar is a very level-headed, even-tempered kind of guy for an ape. I kept wondering, how on earth are they going to make it so that humans are subjugated by the end of this? Like, I'm not, like, I guess you could say, like, they've technically got, like, 2,000 years until they have to bring us Charlton Heston screaming on a beach. But, you know, it seems like they're kind of ramping things up. And I didn't see how that was going to happen with Caesar. So either Caesar has to turn virulently anti-human, which would be an interesting arc, but would destroy a lot of what we love about Caesar. Or Koba shoots him, suddenly Koba's in command, and you get this idea that this entire human-subjugated world is predicated on a great betrayal. And it makes sense that people would be treated so poorly, because Koba would obviously instill a kind of society where humans are treated like he used to be. So it worked for me. It really worked. It was a shock. It was an incredible shock. It was a game changer, in my opinion. And when the apes overwhelm the human defenses and people are being shuttled into basically concentration camps, which are set up very quickly, I guess because FEMA was there and had quarantine zones and stuff set up. It was good. Watching Koba, like, work people and work Caesar, it was like bringing humanity into these apes in the best possible ways for me. Nick, you once said I was an alcoholic and asked me what a beer was based on the can.
Yeah.
Okay. When the guys were drinking Blue Label and, like, Koba comes over and they're like, oh, the monkey wants to drink some alcohol. He takes a big swig and then spits it out.
Yeah.
He legitimately spat out probably $120 worth of liquor.
Mm-hmm.
That hurt me. I just thought that would be a good...
Wait, how much? How much do you think?
You know, depending on where you go, a shot of Blue Label could be like $30 to $40.
Would you ever pay for that?
I have a bottle. I'm not going to buy a shot. The bottle itself is between, depending on the size you get. Like, you could get it at a cheap place for $170, or you could get a slightly better, like, with the velvet box and everything for like $300.
How often would you buy that?
I have had one bottle my entire life.
Oh, okay.
I break it out very specifically.
Every time you see a new ape movie.
Every time a new Planet of the Apes movie comes out.
Is it worth the money? That doesn't sound like it's worth the money.
It's really good, actually.
Okay.
Here's the thing for all my scotch drinking listeners out there. Blue Label has this beautiful smokiness to it. It's a smooth, well-balanced smoke. It almost tastes fruity when you drink it. There's a very little burn in this whiskey. It's so smooth and smoky. And it literally tastes a little bit like Starbursts. Not because they flavored it, but because it evokes that same depth and intensity of flavor. It's really, really quite delicious. Again, this isn't a fruity flavored thing. It's just that it gives you that feeling. It's very warm. Anyway, I sound like an alcoholic remembering the best drink of his life after he's been dry for 5 years. I'll never go dry. Anyway, so yeah, that was interesting. But Koba was a compelling character until he jumped on the horse, and then he became compelling again when he like throws another ape over a balcony.
And you like that?
I liked that moment.
I thought that would, for me, that was actually like the tipping point with Koba.
Really?
Like, you're going too far here.
I was surprised that everyone else didn't do something about it. Like, when I saw that, I was like, oh, this is when the apes are going to, like, come back at Koba, but by now the damage is already done. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, I just thought the whole dynamic was off there.
Yeah.
Seemed a little bit extreme, Koba.
What I really wanted to happen was for Koba, when he shot Caesar, and then he comes up and he's like, oh my god, a human just shot Caesar. And then all the apes are like, we got to kill the humans. I thought he was going to turn to Blue Eyes, which is Caesar's son, and be like, you've got to take over. I told you that you had to watch out for your dad and you didn't, but this is your chance to avenge him. And so I thought he would be like, oh, what's a good pop culture, one of these. He would be his Grand Vizier. He would be his Jafar or his Grima Worm Tongue, and he would pour poison in his ear, and that Blue Eyes would become this kind of tragic, deceived character instead of Koba becoming drunk with power and destroying everything. I wanted this film to end with humans in a concentration camp and Koba having cemented his godlike rule over the apes out of fear and force.
Wow.
Instead, Caesar is found alive, is smuggled back into the city, goes to James Franco's house, is operated on, watches a film of James Franco, and then gets to have like a Great Mouse Detective style battle with Koba on top of a half-finished skyscraper, while Gary Oldman gets to do his best Bane impression because he's got a shit ton of C4 on the foundation of that bitch and he's gonna blow it to sky high. And they've already talked to the military, which is still somewhere out there, and they're gonna come and kill the apes. Caesar wins. Gary Oldman succeeds only in destabilizing the building a little bit. And then Caesar's all like, you guys gotta go, the humans are gonna come, and they're not gonna forgive what we've done. First of all, there is no human society anymore. It seems to be very tribal. Second of all, humanity is so torn up right now that I feel like if Caesar had just stuck around and said, hey guys, this is what happened, we're really sorry, you know, shit happens, I feel like it would be fine. Like, the movie ends on a note where it's like, oh, war's just kind of inevitable now. Guess we better hunker down and get ready for it. But it's like, no one tries to stop it. And I hated it. I hated the ending of this movie. I hated the fact that Caesar survived. And I hated the fact that, like, nothing came of his relationship with his son. And I hated how quickly, like, Gary Oldman goes from a little bit hawkish because he's just so worried about protecting his people, but in general still level-headed, to crazy Tim Robbins in War of the Worlds style, I've got a plan that's going to turn this whole thing around. We got blocks of C4 all over this drain pipe at the bottom of this building, and it's going to bring this fucker on top of us, but we're going to kill these bitches.
I like in that scene how there's that shot where Jason Clark like sees the machine gun like leaning against the wall, and then he just like walks over and picks it up. And the guy's kind of looking at him like, this is weird, but like he's still on our side, right? Like, what is it? And then he just like turns it on him, and it's like,
unless he pulls out his face and he's a monkey, I think I'm still safe. Sorry, ape. But yeah, so that's my take on the ending. That's what really soured the movie for me. Any thoughts about that? Nick, Dan.
I probably would have preferred if the movie ended with the showdown that kind of starts the movie's third act. I think that probably would have been just a more momentous place to end it, because some of the subsequent stuff, the sort of like the jailbreak, whatnot, it was kind of a version of that in Rise already, and that was very well done. So I feel like to kind of retread it is, you know, in the nature of a retread, feels a little tired.
Which is how I felt about the constant human betray us plots.
Right. But I like the final showdown. I liked how the leader who is meant to be level-headed and who's supposed to guide them through it has to show aggression. And the way he, you know, there's something kind of interesting about.
He beat the shit out of Koba in the dam.
No, but that was in front of a few people. Apes. This is in front of. No, but this is in front of numerous apes, and it's also
the whole society.
It's not only a way of asserting power, but it's interesting to think of kind of in relation to something like the fourth movie, the climax of the fourth film specifically, which is a very dark ending. And the connection there I thought was interesting, sort of the idea that, one of the most popular lines from the entire series is, ape must never kill ape, and he says, but you are no ape, and he lets him go.
Yeah.
I guess there's sort of a full circle, complete quality to that for me as a fan of the series, sort of that connection there. It was one of those, it was almost like one of those callbacks that didn't feel too on the nose.
Thought dramatically. From the movie?
What?
Previous movie? You're No Ape? Is that from a previous movie?
Yeah, that's not really, no, but there's a conflict in the fifth one, Battle of the Apes, that is quite similar.
Okay.
I guess I found that dramatically rather powerful. Some of the other stuff is it's a bit draggy. I really don't understand why they go back to James Franco's house. It's really just you could have an excuse to keep a camera with, you know, or to find a camera with footage of James Franco on it.
Yeah.
But you could have just done something where he had the camera with him over the past 10 years.
That's what I thought was going to be happening.
That's definitely the weakest part of the movie. But I guess I found, I found something convincing about the Oldman progression.
Really?
In part because he's off screen most of the movie. So I think that his position, again, keeps kind of getting worse and worse, and it's sort of eroding with these events. And I do think that, again, I think this movie does a good job of establishing reasons for why people do things, people or apes. And I think that his line, I'm saving the human race, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because I think Gary Oldman is a very good actor, but I think there's a lot of sincerity in that line. I think there's also, you know, I think there's a reluctance in it. I think there's a regret that he has to do this, but he does believe that he is really saving the human race. That worked for me. And again, that's an example of just when you cast the right
actor. The explosives didn't work that well.
What?
His explosives didn't work that well.
No.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, he's like, I got bricks of C4 all over the foundation, and he points, and I'm like, there are four bricks. Legitimately four bricks. And this does not seem like that little circle does not seem as though it would cover the entire foundation of whatever the hell that was you were in.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I was so ready to be okay with this film, and it just really, it really let me down at the end. I don't know. But yeah, I feel like between stating it obliquely in the previous section and then stating it outright here in the spoilers, I've pretty much stated what I had to state.
All right.
Any other statements? Any other thoughts before we move on? Perfect. Mm-hmm. Let's get into what's coming out in the week ahead. First, because we're going to be talking about Blu-rays and DVDs, let's give away Enemy and tell you how you can win Under the Skin. So the winner of our Enemy giveaway is Kyle Pletcher. This is at Hair K-Man. Interesting. So he tweeted back to us with his favorite mind-bending thriller. He said Existenz. I gotta say, top choice.
Yeah, good choice.
Damn good choice. So that's cool. Here is the way you can win the Under the Skin Blu-ray. We will be tweeting out a tweet about this contest. You will reply to that tweet. We were going to initially make this trivia. I really wanted to make it trivia about the film to make sure that these weren't just going to people who just like winning contests, but people who actually had seen the film. And then I thought, no, because I would much prefer that someone who hasn't seen this film win it and see it and know how good it is. Tell us what your favorite part of the film is or what you think looks cool about it. Just tell us something about the film. Tell us why you want this film in your life. Don't say Scarlett Johansson's boobs. You won't win. It's not funny. So look for that tweet. Again, that's at Film Stage Show. This is what's coming to Blu-ray. Criterion is doing a Blu-ray release, a re-release of Scanners, 1981 David Cronenberg film. Also a Blu-ray release of re-release of Pickpocket. As we said, Under the Skin coming to Blu-ray. Great film. We talked about it on this show. Feel free to look that up. Rio 2 in 3D. Never saw it. Not really going to comment. I have no reason to. Orphan Black, a very much discussed and apparently wonderful television show, is coming to Blu-ray season 2. So keep an eye out for that. Other than that, I don't really see a lot here that's worth talking about. We got a couple of those weird double feature things that we see sometimes. I'm going to say that my favorite here is Face Off and Snake Eyes. Who could possibly...
Yeah, I was going to say that. That looked pretty, like a pretty good double bill.
I was about to say, these things probably cost $5 in a bin at Best Buy. You could do a lot worse for $5 than Face Off and Snake Eyes.
What's interesting is that Warner Brothers is releasing The Departed and a Richard Gere movie called Internal Affairs.
Oh, I want to see that.
But The Departed...
is based on Infernal Affairs.
Is a remake of a titled Infernal Affairs. I wonder... That has to be deliberate.
It must be. Yeah. 100%. So yeah, any thoughts on any of these guys? Anyone... I mean, obviously I'm going to go with Under the Skin.
You know what's funny? I took an entire class on David Cronenberg this past semester, and I've still never seen Scanners.
Really?
It's like one of his most popular films, and I've still never seen it.
It's a really
Fast
great
Company.
Cover.
I've seen That's Fast Company, cover. And I've seen Crimes of the Future, but I have not seen Scanners. So I'm going to watch that soon. Don't worry.
I'm sure you
I you know, I actually did see Under the Skin back in like April. After a review was recorded, and I didn't really like it that much.
Really?
Yeah, no, I wasn't really such a fan of it. I thought it was kind of stale, honestly. I didn't think it really did much of anything significant with its science fiction trappings. You know, it's no Planet of the Apes.
No. No Rise of / Dawn of / Battle for Planet of the Apes.
Yes. I don't know. To me, it devolves into this very standard, you know, what does it mean to be human story. And some of the earlier stuff was fine, but even then, I wasn't completely gripped. I kind of felt like I was too keyed into the process. However, the first 2 to 2.5 minutes are really good.
Okay.
Because I saw it in a theater, so I actually sat at a point where the movie filled up pretty much my entire field of vision. So the first 2.5 minutes were good, and the final shot was pretty neat. I would say if you were kind of left unsatisfied by it, like myself, watch Trouble Every Day, which is a 2001 Claire Denis film starring Vincent Gallo and Beatrice Dahl. Danny, I know you've seen Trouble Every Day.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, I mean, they're quite watching it. I was thinking, wow, this is Jonathan Glazer totally saw Trouble Every Day, and he really liked it. I give credit to any film that is so clearly influenced by it, but ultimately, I'd just rather watch the earlier incarnation. Under the Skin, I was kind of mixed on. Anyway,
okay.
I need to say my piece.
Way to undercut us.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, let's see. Next week, we'll be talking about Boyhood, which will be expanding to more theaters and cities across the country. So definitely check that out so you can listen to us talk about it. Opening up wide for the opening up new and wide next week, July 18th, we have Sex Tape. I haven't even seen a trailer or a commercial for this. Yet, it has Jason Segel and Cameron Diaz in it. It's a married couple who lost their sex tape, which was a subplot of like 2 minutes in Trainspotting. So, you know, if you want to see that blown up to full length, check it out. We also have The Purge Anarchy. This follows up The Purge, which was a... I don't even know if it was controversial. It launched like a really weird half-drunk debate with a bunch of friends of mine before we'd even seen the movie.
What was the debate?
It was just like, crime is legal for 24 hours. Like, don't you think that would lead to a bunch of crazy shit? And I would be like, no. I honestly think that people would be so terrified that most everyone would stay in their house. Like, I don't see, like, that people would just... I don't think, like, my neighbor is going to be like, you know what? I'm going to go fucking slice up a hobo. I just didn't see it. I didn't see it working because I don't think humanity is like that. But some people did. The movie made some money, and they made a sequel. A sequel that has Frank Grillo, who I love. So maybe I'll actually watch this one. We also have Planes, Fire and Rescue.
Oh, God, the Zach Braff movie.
Oh yeah, Wish I Was Here. The new Zach Braff movie.
That trailer.
It's pretty twee. It is pretty twee.
As a astute person I follow on Twitter said, it's good to see Zach Braff cut out the middleman and just make an indie music video.
That's a good point.
It was funny, one of my friends was going to see a screening of it, and like the day before I like messaged it, and I'm like, let me know how the part is where Zach Braff is like a really good dad.
Also coming out is... Oh,
I should also mention just that Zach Braff has been blocking people on Twitter who don't like the movie.
Yeah, that was interesting.
So actually, Eric D. Snyder, who was a guest on this show a couple of years ago, reviewed it and gave it a negative review, and then he linked to the negative review when the trailer came out. And then... you know, Eric D. Snyder has like a wacky Twitter photo, so Zach Braff posted it as like a fuck you, like, you know, you're some weirdo or something, and then he blocked him without ever directly interacting with him. Wow. Because he's such a cunt.
So funny.
Is the thing. And then he blocked me too, which was beautiful.
Wait, how did you get blocked?
Oh, because I said you're a child, basically. which granted.
How do you know that he blocked you? Because you can't look at him anymore.
No, because I clicked the follow button to check, and it said, yeah, you have been blocked at the request of this user.
Oh, my God.
Basically, the
All
point
the cool
is
kids
that...
All getting
that,
blocked by Zach Braff. I'm still... He probably still could see mine if he wanted to. Shit.
The point is, that movie's probably going to be garbage, and you were a bad person if you pay to see it, when a movie like Boyhood is playing.
Sweet.
That's all I'm saying. But don't mind me.
I, Origins is also coming out. This is a follow-up by Mike Cahill to his previous film, which was Another Earth, which was something that I liked a lot. I don't really know what this is about, and I like it that way. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I haven't seen a trailer.
The trailer's really bad.
I haven't read anything, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. I liked his first film. I liked Another Earth. I think it struck a balance that I liked. So I'll see iOrigins.
Report back if you see it.
I will. I don't know where I'll see it. There's also a lot of other small stuff coming out. Is anyone... Aside from Boyhood, obviously, which we're going to talk about next week, anything?
Oh, I watched this movie called Fanny.
Fanny?
Which is like, I think it's opening at the Quad Cinema in New York for like a week.
Oh, so it's really good.
Oh, good. Great.
No, yeah, but it's interesting.
Keeping us as a wide appealing...
The actor from Cachet, I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Daniel O'Toole, he started directing in recent years, so this is one of his... recent films, and they're all like period melodramas, but he's sort of like filled out a little bit from Cachet, so his persona now is like you're sort of like grumpy like grandfather type. It's like weird, but I guess Cachet was like 10 years ago now, but
yeah, that was actually
but yeah, Fanny's okay.
Fanny's all right. Anyway, now that I've thrown some Cheap Trick into the mix, let's talk about what we've watched on our own briefly, and then we will get going, and we'll talk to y'all next week about Boyhood. So, Nick Newman, kick us off. Why don't you briefly tell us about something that you watched on your own this week that you think we should check out?
So, the people at Raro Video were kind enough to send us, Brian and I, a Blu-ray of Michelangelo Antonioni's 1953 picture, I Vinti. This was his second feature after... Story of a Love Affair, which I have also seen, and which I like very much. Antonioni is one of my favorite directors. He's a top 10 for me, honestly. And I am a little short on his earlier work. I have seen Story of a Love Affair, and then I've seen Le Amiche. But there are two films that he made in the 50s, which I haven't seen. Well, there were, I Vinti and The Lady Without Camellias. I've now seen I Vinti. So there are very few of his features I have not yet seen. Therefore, I feel confident in saying how much I really do love his work. And it's satisfying to go back to an early film from a director you love and to see sort of the seeds of their greatness. but not only see the seeds of their greatness, but also find things to appreciate in the films, or early incarnations of things that they would expound upon in later, more well-known. Eventi is a three-part story, all three stories concerning crime and particularly the reasons why a person commits a crime. A lot of times it has to do with money. And the stories at hand are, I think, on the surface a bit familiar, but the connections that form between them makes for something much more powerful. This movie has a really great cumulative effect where for something like the first half hour, I was kind of not with it, and I wasn't exactly sure why I was watching what was being presented, despite it being very well photographed and very well performed and having, as is usual with Antonioni, very observant, astute dialogue exchanges. I was kind of not with it. And then once the first crime in the first segment is committed, it begins blossoming, and the movie keeps evolving as it goes on. And it becomes this really, I think, rather unfortunate story of people just being bound to make mistakes, and people being bound to make mistakes because they are greedy, which I think is something that has come up in other Antonioni movies. That's kind of a key theme in his film L'Eclisse. And there's also this focus on metropolitan spaces, the way that living in a city affects a person, the way that the cluster of a city can warp a person's brain, basically. And that kind of shows up here in a nascent form for Antonioni. It's clearly something that he's working through. It's something that he's trying to develop. And if it's not quite as powerful here as it is in later masterpieces, that's fine, because those films are masterpieces. And if this one isn't, well, again, that's fine, because it doesn't have to be. It's just a very good film. I would recommend it to pretty much anybody who's interested in Antonioni. If you don't really know his work, this is probably not the place to start, despite it being an early title, because I don't think it's going to give you a great idea of what makes his film so special. But go back to this when you can. I'm glad that Raro Video are helping make it more available. I had wanted to see it for a while. It's been on DVD since, I think, 2007 or 2008, but the DVD itself is not widely available. So, you know, it's coming around. And the Blu-ray disc includes a rare short of his, and also an extended version of one of the three segments. It's a good disc, and it's a very good film. Eventi gets a recommendation from me. And I guess on to the few remaining Antonioni pictures I have not seen.
Yeah, and I really wanted to be able to see this too so we could talk about it, but my Blu-ray player crapped out on me.
Yeah.
So I gotta get that shit fixed. Danny King, what about yourself? I'm still gonna see it, and I'm still gonna say my piece about it, because I'm interested to see it as well. Especially now that you've given it a recommendation, Nick. I know how... What's the good word I'm looking for? Discerning you can be.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, welcome. Danny King, what about yourself?
That sounds really good. I'm going to, discuss a less prestigious picture.
I'm pretty sure that mine will be the least prestigious.
No.
wow, now I'm really excited.
A 1976 horror film called Squirm.
Okay, maybe you've got me beat.
Very low budget horror film. A series just started at Lincoln Center, which has some films people know. Like next week, they're showing American Psycho. But this one was Squirm, and the theater's like 2 minutes from where I live, and it was like 11 p.m. on Friday, and it was showing on 35 millimeter. So I'm like, I gotta go see what Squirm is. And actually, the pleasant surprise.
Wait, I just read the synopsis.
Yeah, it's amazing.
This is fantastic.
And yeah, this actually begins with a title card explaining the circumstances. That is like, that's really funny. But yeah, and actually, you know, the movie itself was enjoyable and pretty much what you'd expect. But the director was actually there beforehand in like an unplanned discussion. So the guy who was introducing the movie ended up asking the director a few questions. The director's name is Jeff Lieberman. And I think this was his first feature. And the funniest stories he had to tell were about the actors he passed up. And so one of them was Kim Basinger, who was like 21 at the time. And I think he just said like she wouldn't be able to, you know, portray this like Southern girl or something. So he passed her up. But the funnier one was Martin Sheen, because he said he hired Sheen, and then right before the movie started, Martin Sheen like asked him out for drinks to discuss the backstory of the main character. And so Martin Sheen asked the director, like, yeah, so like, where's this guy from? And like, you know, what did he do before? And the director's like, what? Like, what do you mean backstory? And Martin Sheen is like, well, what if he was like an actor? And the director was like, yeah, that's fine. He was an actor. And then there's a scene in the movie where the character looks at a skull. And so Martin Sheen was like, you know, what if in this scene, you know, I can recite some Shakespeare? And so the director, like, he eventually fired Martin Sheen.
For being too committed.
Yeah, because he's like, we have 5 weeks to shoot. One of them is with Worms only. So we have 4 weeks to shoot with the actors. I can't be wasting time talking about Shakespeare. And so he fired Martin Sheen.
That's incredible.
And yeah, it was funny like hearing him reminisce about that, because he's like, yeah, so he's like, I'm really pissed off that my producers like put so much stock in my opinion. But yeah, so those stories are really funny. And the movie itself was enjoyable. A lot of worms. He said they used over 250,000 worms on the movie.
I looked up some of the pictures from this movie.
Yeah.
It looks pretty incredible.
Yeah, the one with the face is probably the best scare in the movie.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay. This is such a weird eclectic mix we've got today.
Antonioni and Squirm.
Antonioni Squirm, and I'm going to pull us right back to the center. So I was on Netflix the other day. And Netflix, you know, with its brilliant little algorithm, it knows exactly what I'm going to want to watch all the time. And so it popped up and it's like, hey, check out what we got for you. And what was it showing me but the 1996 action-adventure film starring Michael Douglas and Val Kilmer, The Ghost and the Darkness. This is a movie based on a pretty incredible true story about two lions that were hunting a British railroad camp and killed a shit ton of people. Two male lions who were hunting both at night and during the day. And this is a dramatic portrayal of that incredible story. And Val Kilmer is Colonel John Patterson. And he is the bridge builder. And Michael Douglas is this kind of bananas great white hunter guy who comes in when Val Kilmer is unsuccessful at taking out the two lions. And the two lions are causing kind of havoc in the camp, and no one feels safe. Everyone's scared. It's not a great day. It's not a great day to be a worker on a railroad in Africa. The movie sort of glazes over the imperialism on display, but how do I say this? It knows that it's a problem, but it knows enough to not make it a forefront thing, because obviously, you know, the English characters wouldn't give a shit. The other characters, the native populations, wouldn't be capable of doing something, and that's not how it happened, and there's two killer lions on the loose. So, yeah. It's a good movie. I like it a lot. It's weird, because I remember the movie feeling very small and cheap, but on rewatch, it actually is quite beautiful, and I thought that the production values were really good. So I don't know what the hell was wrong with me when I was a kid when I first saw this. Maybe it's just because I know it was from 1996, and I know that its reputation isn't that high, that I just assumed that I was misremembering it. But no, I really liked it. It's a fine, ripping action-adventure yarn, and it's on Netflix, so you should check that shit out.
Wow.
Has anyone else seen The Ghost of the Darkness?
No, it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I'm also the guy who likes The Edge.
I saw that movie like years ago, but I remember it being kind of enjoyable.
Yeah, I like Man versus Beast. You know, like these.
Yeah.
Not really so much the Jaws, because that's like a big shark, so it feels a little extra to me. But like, you know, someone who's being hunted and turns the tables. I like that. I like Man versus Wilderness type stuff. I think I like The Edge a little more than The Ghost in the Darkness, just because it was written by David Mamet. How can you not?
Oh, okay.
But yeah, The Edge and The Ghost in the Darkness. So I watched The Ghost in the Darkness. Check it out. That's all. That's it for today. Join us next week. We'll be talking about Boyhood. Keep an eye on Twitter to figure out how you, or see where to tweet. Just keep an eye on Twitter to see what to tweet back to us to win that Under the Skin Blu-ray. And, yeah, follow us on all these other wonderful places. Nick Newman, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me as usual at thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman. I should mention, this is actually not a joke.
I was about to say, really? Really? You're going to pull this shit again?
Yeah. I should mention that Danny and I actually have a little project that is premiering this week by the time the episode airs. So at the website tobecontinued.com, the URL is actually TOBECONTD. Over the month of July, or I guess maybe into mid-August or early to mid-August.
Late start.
Yeah, Danny and I will be having a four-part conversational series on the films of Todd Haynes, the director of works such as I'm Not There, Involve a Gold Mine, and Safe, Far From Heaven. And you can find that I wrote the first of four pieces. That's going to be up on their site on Monday, again, by the time this episode airs. So you can find it there and follow along week after week for 4 weeks. So, yeah, there's that as well.
Pretty awesome. Good work.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Excellent. Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, you know.
Nick, you said all your other things too, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the filmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, twitter.com/thekingbulletin. And this month for July, at tobecontinued.com. Nick and I will be just yeah, you know what I mean.
It's funny because if you had gone first and then Nick started doing that, we would think it was a joke, but then it would turn out that he actually just wasn't listening.
Yeah.
Ahem. Anyway.
That's never happened before.
No, that's
so
never
I don't know.
In the history of
it's
this
not parent. Like you're alluding to anything.
So anyway, I can be found at deerfilm.net. Look for my newly refined opinion on Snowpiercer coming up sometime this week. You can also find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, and of course at the Film Stage, thefilmstage.com. Thank you, everyone. Join us next week when we talk Boyhood.